From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Rioters attacked police in Hong Kong following a dispute with street vendors. Local media in Hong Kong reported that unrest broke out early Tuesday in downtown Kowloon as more than 100 people, including street vendors, hurled stones at police and set fire to garbage. Those reports said police fired tear gas and warning shots to control the crowd. Media in China and Japan described the clashes as the worst since 2014, when police cleared pro-Western demonstrators from the streets after more than 2 months of protests. CCTV's Lin Zijun was in Hong Kong and filed this report Tuesday.
From Monday night to early morning on Tuesday, Mong Kok, the scene of some of the worst unrest during the Occupy protests in 2014, was again plunged into chaos. More than 100 protesters, some of them so-called localists, launched attacks on the police. Of the over 120 people were injured in unrest, the ACI government classified it as a riot. Trouble began after the police attempted to clear illegal street vendors. Hundreds of protesters set fires and attacked police with self-made weapons and shields. They threw rocks, rubbish bins, and glass bottles towards the police, who responded with batons and pepper spray.
This is one of the streets where the unrest happened last night. The eyewitnesses said the paving stones were being ripped up and the brakes were being hurled at police officers on duty. And as the situation went out of control, one police officer fired 2 shots in the air.
Police fired warning shots in the bid to protect the injured officers and contain protesters. The overnight unrest lasted 8 hours. The police are investigating the riot. The officers said there were indications that it was an organized activity.
In this incident, it was discovered that some people transported supplies by vehicles for use by the violent radicals at scene. Police do not rule out that it was an organized and pre-planned action. Police will conduct follow-up investigations and take enforcement actions. The possibility of further arrests cannot be ruled out.
The clashes are the most violent since the Occupy Central movement in 2014, where protesters paralyzed downtown Hong Kong for more than 2 months. The government says it will do everything it can to find those responsible and bring them to justice. Now Kong has returned to Mong Kok. Roads which had been blocked earlier also reopened, and the crowds have begun to stream in again.
Turkish police fired tear gas at thousands of people protesting in the city of Diyarbakir, a Kurdish-majority city that has seen demonstrations against the continued crackdown on Kurdish activists by security forces of President Recep Erdogan. Shops and schools were closed in protest in the city in the southeastern part of Turkey. A few thousand protesters had gathered in the city center to take part in a rally, but were met by police vehicles which deployed tear gas and water cannons against them. There were also media reports of gunfire. Tuesday's violence followed similar disturbances Monday, with tanks deployed on the streets and reports of gunfire across the entire city. A RIA Novosti correspondent reported that columns of black smoke could be seen rising above the city. Also on Monday, approximately 60 people were reported killed in the basement of a building in the southeastern Kurdish town of Sizra during a military raid which, according to Turkish state media, was conducted to neutralize Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, fighters. The Turkish army conducted the raid to allegedly clear out what it claimed were high-profile PKK members, that according to local media. An earlier incident in that city in late January led UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Ra'ad Al Hussein, to urge Erdogan's government to investigate the shooting of unarmed people after footage emerged of innocent people being shot. Since the collapse in July of a 2.5-year ceasefire between Ankara and the PKK, southeastern Turkey has experienced its worst violence in 2 decades as Kurds fight for the right of self-determination and greater autonomy from Ankara. 40,000 people have been killed in the conflict since 1984. Although the U.S. and Turkey are allies, Both are members of NATO. The relationship to the PKK has recently diverged substantially. A YouTube video posted last month showed Kurdish Peshmerga and PKK forces working with American Special Operation Forces, allegedly battling ISIS south of Kirkuk. The differences between Washington and Ankara with respect to the Kurds has made the dance around Syrian peace talks even more complex, with Turkey refusing to sit down with the Kurds, despite the fact that the Kurds have been major allies of both the U.S. coalition and the Syrian Arab Army in the fight against ISIS. On Tuesday, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that Turkey's position on the involvement of Syria's Kurds in peace talks was not shared by anyone else and reflected Ankara's arrogance. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Russian activities in Syria and the region were making it more difficult to hold peace talks and called on Moscow to bring about an immediate ceasefire. His remarks came amid recent gains by the Syrian army in Aleppo province, backed by Russian airstrikes. Last week, the latest round of talks between the Syrian government and opposition groups was adjourned for 3 weeks. Washington's call for a unilateral ceasefire by the Syrian government and its Russian ally was rejected by Moscow. This was Russia's ambassador to the United Nations, Vitaly Churkin, this past Friday.
We were, of course, upset that the talks, after just starting, were not continued. We believe that the Ariad delegation, if I may call it this way, the opposition group, which presented itself as the main participant from the opposition, in our view, did not really come to negotiate. They came to look for a pretext to walk out of the negotiations. We are disappointed that the opposition was not as representative as it is supposed to be in accordance with the Geneva Communique in 2012 and Resolution 2254. We think that the talks have been weakened by the fact that Turkey went out of its way to block the participation of Syrians in part of the country, so they must be there as well. We are disappointed that what we call the Cairo-Moscow platform group of the opposition was not properly represented in Geneva. They came in, but with a status which was not fully official. So we do believe that additional work needs to be done when the talks resume to present the opposition in a more formidable, if you will, way, and in a way which would be more conducive to productive discussions with the Syrian government. The Syrian government was there, and it was prepared to enter into discussions with the opposition. Now, there was also a discussion of the environment surrounding the talks, and we heard again that some things need to happen on the ground for the talks to continue. And some colleagues, yes, they did criticize Russia for continuing this bombing campaign, with the help of which the Syrian government has been able to reconquer some ground which was taken from their control by terrorists and other opposition groups. In fact, I'd like to point out that in the area of Aleppo, some sieges were lifted which have been there for a couple of years. So in the process of this offensive, in a way, some humanitarian objectives have also been achieved. However, of course, fighting is fighting, and it creates additional difficulties on the ground. My point, the point I was making in the consultations in response to that criticism, is that all those things needed to be addressed during those talks. So those people who have encouraged the opposition to essentially walk out of the text of the talks, who have been refusing our continued offers for them to arrange really practical cooperation between us and them in the situation of Syria, they do not really have much of a ground to criticize us, no moral or formal ground, if you will, to criticize us. We cannot stop this unilaterally. I mean, why don't you stop this bombing campaign? But what about the terrorists and opposition groups? Are they going to stop too? What about this American-led coalition? Are they going to stop too? My point was that all those things need to be discussed, and we were sorry that that discussion did not start in Geneva, along with the problems in the humanitarian situation, humanitarian supplies. They were on the table in Geneva, and the opposition delegation walked out. Unfortunately, it seems encouraged by some of our Western colleagues. But, you know, we are used to things in and around Syria being extremely complicated. We are not resting with our efforts to continue to do things in the proper direction in Syria. As you know, another meeting of the International Syria Support Group is planned for Munich, 11th of February. We are going to bring some new ideas to the table, and we hope that other colleagues, other members of the International Syria Support Group are going also to show their responsibility, because we have been able to cover a very serious road in creating the Vienna Group and having two or three successful meetings of the Vienna Group, passing Resolution 2254 here in New York when ministers were here. So we need to continue making that progress.
Another complication for the peace effort in Syria was the announcement late last week that Saudi Arabia and Turkey plan to place their own troops on the ground inside Syria. That announcement was the topic of discussion with State Department spokesperson John Kirby at his Monday briefing.
Can we get are you able to offer a comprehensive and coherent reaction, U.S. administration reaction, to the Saudi offer and now the UAE offer of ground troops? I keep hearing, well, we welcome the idea of giving more assistance to the coalition, but I'm looking for something from a U.S. official who actually says, yeah, we think this is a good idea, or no, we think this is a bad idea.
The UAE has come in and offered to contribute to this force. Then there was some talk about that with the foreign minister, Al-Jubeir, over the course of these last two meetings. And again, as I said last week, we welcome this. As it is focused on Daesh, which it is, we certainly welcome their willingness to contribute to the effort in this particular way. But as I also said, I mean, we still just, you know, need to get a better sense of obviously what they envision this would entail and make sure that it matches up with coalition efforts and coalition needs. But again, no equivocation, we welcome the announcement and we welcome the support that they're willing to provide, given that it is going after Daesh. And number two, as I said before, we've been saying for a while, we want other nations in the coalition to intensify their efforts just like we are ours.
Okay. Well, the foreign minister said outside after the meeting that anything that they do with these troops would be part of the coalition, and the coalition is U.S.-led, suggesting, therefore, that the U.S. would lead this ground force, or command it at some point, these troops that the Saudis and the Emiratis are. Is that correct? Because I thought that the administration, the position of the president was that there would be no boots on the ground in Syria.
I did not hear the foreign minister's comments specifically. He's right, the coalition is U.S.-led. There's no doubt about that. But there's also been absolutely no change to the commander-in-chief's intention not to have a large U.S. military footprint on the ground in Syria. Now, as you know, he has approved, and I won't get into too much Pentagon equity here, but he has approved small numbers of special operations forces to help in an advise and assist capacity, and if needed, a more direct CT capacity inside Syria. But again, I'd let the Pentagon speak to that. There's no change to, at least from our understanding here at the State Department, no change to the broader perspective and the broader policy that there won't be a large, conventional, sustained U.S. military presence on the ground there in Syria. And as you know, we do have quote-unquote boots on the ground when it comes to fighting Daesh, but those are to the tune of about 3,700 U.S. troops in Iraq that are largely in a train, advise, and assist capacity.
Can I also follow up from Matt saying, first of all, the Saudi foreign minister's remarks today kind of moved on from what they were saying, where they're prepared to participate in ground operations, and he was specifically said a special forces contingent that they had told you that they are prepared to give. Would that be more helpful to the coalition? And where do you see those operations?
Certainly, any addition to in a special operations capacity, any addition to the effort on the ground there in Syria would be welcome and could be significant. But again, back to what I said last week, that we still want to talk to the Saudis about this and get a better sense. But on the whole, on the face of it, we certainly do welcome an effort or desire to intensify efforts. And, and as I said, in a special operations role, that could certainly be meaningful. But again, I think we just need to continue to talk about
it. And then on the... troops to one side to be ready in case there's a decision to intensify.
I'm not aware of any specific request that was made of them to do so.
So do you know, are they talking to the military about this? Do you know if they talked?
I don't know. I can only speak for the conversations that Secretary Kerry's had with Foreign Minister Joubert.
In your assessment, or in the administration's assessment, does Saudi Arabia have the capacity to send in such a ground force? One would assume that it would have to be in the tens of thousands to have any effect, while it is in fact involved in a war in Yemen. In fact, it also depends on many recruits that come from Pakistan, Ethiopia, others, and so on. So they do have the capacity to actually send a formidable ground force that can bring the proper outcome?
They certainly have a professional, competent military and ground force. They certainly have capabilities within the special operations realm. I would let the Saudis speak to specifically how many they're talking about and exactly where they would go and what they intend or what they would want them to do. And I would fully expect that all that would be coordinated with the larger coalition, as all military efforts against Daesh inside the coalition are coordinated.
Where would they come from? They would have to go through a place like Jordan, maybe, so you would need to coordinate with Jordan.
I don't know. Those are second and third order questions I can't possibly answer. And that would be more in the military realm.
The reason I ask these questions, I want to see how imminent this thing is. I mean, are we talking about maybe in weeks, in months, in a year? What is your assessment? Is this really an imminent interference by the Saudis?
First of all, I don't think I'd characterize it as interference. It would be a contribution to coalition efforts against Daesh on the ground in Syria. We don't consider that interference, as I said earlier. An intensification of the effort could be helpful. Please let me finish. I'm not going to speak for timing. That's for the Saudis to speak to. This is a proposal that they have made, a contribution that they are willing to put forward, and they should speak to the timing and the specifics of that, not the United States. Clearly, we want to stay in close consultation with them moving forward, as we would any contribution of a member to the coalition, particularly in the military line of effort. But I just don't have any more details on this right now.
The reason I said one last thing is because, to the best of my knowledge, there are no ground troops from any other country in Syria. So this would be a first, so to speak, right?
Well, the president's already talked about a small U.S. special operations effort there inside Syria. If you're talking about a third party member on the ground in any significant number, I'm not aware of any. But again, I'd point you to the Pentagon for more granularity on that. I don't have the order of battle in front of me. What matters is that it helps whatever this is and whatever it ends up being, that it intensifies the efforts and puts more pressure on Daesh, contributes to our overall effort to degrade and destroy them, in this case in Syria, but obviously we have a larger effort in Iraq and Syria as well, and that it's coordinated inside the coalition and part of coalition efforts, and that's important. And the Saudis have indicated a willingness to work inside that construct, and that's why we welcome it.
Can you be a little bit more specific about what exactly they're offering? I listened to the foreign minister outside, and it wasn't entirely clear. And are you able to say, are they offering a large ground force contingent on a U.S. ground force to go with it? Or are they offering a smaller special forces operation that would work in concert with U.S. special forces?
I think it's premature for me to go into any great detail at this time. First of all, it's a Saudi proposal, and I think we should let the Saudis speak to it and characterize it the way that they want to. We are talking about a ground element. We have discussed the potential value of a special operations capability inside that element, which would be valuable. But as I said, we're still having discussions with them on this, and I wouldn't want to get ahead of any final decisions that they have or haven't made. Ultimately, these are just as Matt's question on the Canadians and an announcement they made with respect to their F-18s. That's for them to speak to. It's for each nation to speak to their own military contributions, not for us to.
Apart from the Saudi offer, does the U.S. believe that the way to turn the tide against ISIL inside Syria is to have some sort of ground troop presence?
I won't speak to military tactics, and that's not my place here. That said, we have always maintained that you need to continue to put pressure on this group, and that the way to do that is a combination of pressure from the air and pressure from the ground. Now, in Iraq, largely that effort on the ground has been conducted by Iraqi security forces, and our role on the ground has been to help improve the capability and competence of those forces. In Syria, there are several groups that have been operating against Daesh on the ground, and we have provided some assistance as well. And now the president has deemed fit to intensify our efforts in Syria by ordering the Pentagon to contribute a small number, special operations forces, primarily an advise and assist role. We welcome this proposal by the Saudis to intensify their efforts by introducing some sort of ground elements in Syria to, again, intensify the pressure on Daesh. Exactly what that's going to look like and how that's going to play out, I just don't think we can say right now. But if it can lead to further degrading and destroying their capabilities on the ground, well, that's a good thing, and we want to continue to have that discussion.
It seems on the ground that opposite the U.S. arguments, Russians supported Syrian regime forces and Hezbollah are making gains. Why should the Russians change tactics if they see they are winning on the ground?
Our argument is they should stop doing this because in bolstering the Assad regime, they are doing nothing but prolonging the conflict and making it much harder for us to get to any political resolution or transition of any kind. It was in part, as I said last week, because of Russian military support to regime forces on the ground in and around Aleppo that the talks in Geneva weren't able to go forward. And the special envoy had to pause them. So the argument to the Russians are, A, you made a commitment that you would support a ceasefire and humanitarian access, so you got to live up to your commitments. They didn't just make them verbally, they made them in writing. Number two, further support of the Assad regime and bolstering him and empowering him is just prolonging the conflict in Syria and making it that much harder, not just for the Syrian people, obviously, but for neighboring nations like Turkey, which is already dealing with an immense refugee problem on their side of the border, and security issues of their own along that border, which we recognize. So the arguments are all there in the plain for the Russians to do the right thing. Now, why they haven't done the right thing, you'd have to ask them. But they made commitments. We expect them to meet their commitments. Again, the secretary was very, very strong on that last week when he talked publicly, and I can tell you he's equally as strong when he talks privately with Russian leaders. Yeah.
On Syria, too, Syrian aid workers met with the secretary in London last week, quoted the secretary saying or telling them that Syria should expect another 3 months of bombing that would decimate the opposition. And they added that the secretary has blamed the Syrian opposition for leaving the talks and paving the way for a joint offensive by the Syrian government and Russia on Aleppo. Do you have anything on this?
Well, I'm not going to. First of all, I wasn't party to this conversation. That said, the secretary is making no predictions about 3 months this or 3 months that. He has said publicly, and he said so as recently as Friday, publicly, that unless we can get to a ceasefire that everybody has signed up to and humanitarian access to the areas everybody has agreed needs it, then the conflict will be prolonged. I just said that in my prior answer. So I don't know of any prediction he's made in terms of this many months, but certainly he has been very open and frank about his very real concern that should support to the Assad regime continue, Should Russian military activity still be designed to go after opposition groups instead of terrorists, that the situation in Syria is not going to get better, probably will get worse, and could go on in a very unfortunate way. I wouldn't begin to predict how long. As for the opposition, there's been no badgering of the opposition. And again, the secretary addressed this as well on Friday, that all along we wanted the regime and the opposition to participate in these proximity talks and get them going without precondition. Because if you put preconditions on it, you make it too easy, certainly for the regime and its supporters, to use that as an excuse not to talk and not to sit down and not to begin any dialogue. Also, by being able to have talks, hopefully, ideally, you can start to get at the issues that are most of prime importance, which is a ceasefire and humanitarian access. It's hard to do that when you're not even having a dialogue. It's certainly hard to do that when, as we saw, when people are being bombed and they're not being able to get food and water and medical supplies. But there was no badgering of the opposition here, and there was no blame game, except that what you saw the secretary say very publicly last week, which was that he felt the regime itself and its supporters, yes, including Russia, did contribute to an atmosphere in Geneva that was not conducive to productive dialogue, and seemed to indicate that what the regime in Russia believe is that there is a military solution to a problem that we always have maintained there can only be a political solution for.
One more on this too. Foreign Minister Al-Jubeir has just said that he discussed with the secretary how to intensify the aids to the opposition to stop the offense made by the Russians and the regime. Is the U.S. involved in intensifying the aids to the opposition, or can you elaborate on this?
I think in general terms, Foreign Minister Jubeir has it right. We are talking about ways we can intensify our efforts, but I'm not going to go into any great detail.
Syria?
Go ahead.
In your estimation, with the Syrian government's advance in Aleppo, which is backed up by Russian airstrike, how does that affect the effectiveness of the Syrian opposition party? And in their role of the process, do you think they actually complicate the resumption of those peace talks?
I think I just dealt with that. Obviously, I said that publicly here from the podium, that that certainly the continued bombing carried out by Russian military aircraft in support of regime forces on the ground made it that much harder for us, for the opposition, to continue to stay in Geneva and have a dialogue over a potential way forward politically. No question about that. Your other question on Aleppo and what the effect it's having on the opposition, well, clearly we know that opposition targets are still being struck and opposed by regime forces, all of which is, again, making it that much harder for us to get to some sort of political resolution here. Which is why it's going to be so important going into this week and going into Munich that we lay this bare on the table and have a meaningful discussion with all the parties there in the ISSG about how to stop it so that we can resume the political discussions that were attempted in Geneva last week. The choices that have to be made here are the choices about how we as a coalition are going to intensify our efforts to degrade and destroy this group in Iraq and Syria. Those are the choices which nations need to make. Those are the choices that we are certainly going to make.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.